The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at G. Suggs Insurance, that's G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine, the April 6, 2026 edition. Beginning with The View, Inbox, Health Matters, by Veronique Greenwood, staff writer. There are more than 170 rhinoviruses known to science. These causes of the common cold are found in noses all around you, and while rhinovirus infections are known for yielding lots of snot and self-pity, often they cause no symptoms at all. But if rhinoviruses are relatively benign for most people, an infection can be deadly for others. The past few decades have revealed rhinovirus infections are behind a staggering number of asthma attacks and a leading cause of flare-ups for people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, causing breathlessness and coughing that can become dangerous if left untreated. The differences in symptom severity do not seem to be down to the virus itself. It is pretty clear now that if you give someone with asthma or COPD a rhinovirus, and then you give the same dose of rhinovirus to a healthy person, the response is quite different, says Aaron Singhanayagam, a clinician scientist at Imperial College London who studies respiratory disease. To get a better understanding of why this happens, scientists have turned to nasal tissue grown in a dish, which they infect with rhinovirus. In a new paper in the journal Cell Press Blue, that's C-E-L-L, Press Blue, researchers report that if the tissue's first-line defenses fail, what could have been a mild infection spirals out of control. That confirms with data from individual cells that differences in the host's immune system, not the virus's behavior, are behind these effects. When dish-grown tissue catches a cold, only a handful of cells are actually infected with the virus, says Ellen Foxman, a professor of immunobiology at Yale School of Medicine and an author of the new paper. We see something very similar to what you would often see in a person with a mild or asymptomatic cold, she says. Only about 1% of the cells got infected. All cells in the tissue, though, had changed behavior. Molecules released by the infected cells, known as interferons, acted as warning signals to their comrades, causing them to activate their antiviral defenses. As a result, the virus could not spread beyond the first infected cells. What happened if that interferon signal did not go out? Foxman and her colleagues asked. They blocked the warning using a drug and watched as something completely different unfolded. Before their eyes, the tissue started to ooze mucus, and they found the cells began to produce signals meant to provoke inflammation. That's what you see in people with a cold or people with asthma or COPD attacks. You see excessive mucus production, and you see those inflammatory cells coming to the lung, Foxman says. The timing really matters, she continues. If that response is delayed enough to let the virus replicate and get big enough to trigger other pathways, that is when you're going to see the symptoms. Indeed, that delay agrees with what's been seen in other studies, says Nathan Bartlett, a professor at University of Newcastle in Australia and Hunter Medical Research Institute, who studies rhinovirus. We found that if you took cells from an airway that's been chronically exposed to inflammation, there's been a desensitization, he says. It just takes them a bit longer to realize there's an infection, so there's a delay, we saw, by about 24 hours. For a rhinovirus, that's huge. A 24-hour delay means the virus can double its numbers multiple times before neighboring cells get the message. When cells do finally respond, there's a lot more virus to fight, and the effects can be much more damaging. This new study notably involved only a subset of nasal cells. The dish-grown tissue did not have specialized immune cells, for instance, that would be called in when an intact human nose got wind of a virus. However, the study lays out the signals cells send when the first line of defense is missing, which Foxman hopes will help provide targets for drugs to prevent dangerous reactions to rhinovirus. The window to intervene in the inflammatory process that seems to kick off in the absence of normal signaling is very small, however. Bartlett speculates it might make the most sense to think of a more universal treatment, or even perhaps developing a vaccine, yes, a vaccine for colds, that could protect the vulnerable before complications arise. I have seen a number of papers recently that are talking about universal vaccines, he says, which might stimulate the immune system to provide protection against viruses of all kinds. Indeed, a recent study found mice could be protected from COVID-19, influenza, and other respiratory infections with a treatment that put the immune system on high alert. If such a vaccine is ever brought to the clinic, scientists will be watching to see how it plays out with rhinoviruses. We can bring rhinovirus into the conversation now, he says, because that is probably the virus we're going to be encountering, actually, more than anything. So we better start thinking about it. CO2 Leadership Report by Justin Moreland, senior correspondent. In some ways, the annual summit of the Sustainable Markets Initiative was notably merely for continuing on. Convening CEOs from major American firms like Bank of America and Trane Technologies at an event with sustainability in the title is no easy feat in 2026, amid an accelerating energy crisis and a U.S. administration keen on attacking anything with even a veneer of green. But the discussions in London in March actually underscored how the current economic and geopolitical context amplify the business case for sustainable practices. The global benchmark price for crude oil quickly topped $100 per barrel when Iran shut down transit through the Strait of Hormuz. The picture's even worse for gas. The spot price for liquefied natural gas doubled in parts of Asia, leading factories to close. You are all CEOs, and I'm sure you're sitting around saying, well, now, we've been reminded of what we learned in 1973, which is you need energy independence. John Kerry, former U.S. Secretary of State and climate envoy, told the crowd, you are not safe. There is no security if you are dependent on the Strait of Hormuz or the Red Sea or somewhere else. In the past, geopolitical conflagrations have been framed as a matter primarily for nation states to address, and despite the obvious advantages, renewable energy has not always won out in challenging moments, as governments have often relied on easier short-term subsidies for existing energy sources to quell consumer and voter concerns. This time around, energy price volatility is a wake-up call for corporate leaders newly empowered to do something about it. Many companies are facing what is in effect a COVID moment, a fundamental breakage in supply chains, said Ron O'Hanley, CEO of U.S. financial services giant State Street. When we get to the other end of this, nobody's going to leave themselves to be exposed like that. The possibilities for big companies to respond effectively on their own have changed dramatically in the past two decades. The widespread adoption of power purchase agreements has allowed big companies to lock in fixed prices for renewable electricity for decades. Efficiency solutions spurred by the climate and sustainability push over the past two decades from smart buildings to low-carbon vehicles have made it easier for companies to quickly realize a return on such investments. And technologies like solar and battery storage have enabled companies to affordably invest in their own power generation. As Australian mining magnate Andrew Forrest told me, if you democratize your energy and bring your costs down to what it should be, which is cost of capital plus maintenance, then you're going to have abundant energy for citizens and shareholders. The View, essay, subtitle, Society. You cannot predict the future, but can you rehearse it? By Frank Diana, who is a futurist at Tata Consultancy Services. When people learn that I am a futurist, they often assume my work involves precisely predicting what comes next. From election results and new technologies to market crashes and natural disasters, to be clear, I cannot predict the future. But the desire for someone to, is understandable. In moments of instability, prediction feels like reassurance, a way to impose older order on uncertainty. Yet the expectation itself rests on a fragile premise, because prediction has never been reliable, even during periods we now remember as calm or more stable. The historical record makes this clear. Economic forecasts routinely fail to anticipate recessions, political predictions collapse at moments of realignment, and technological change arrives earlier, later, or in forms few expected. To understand the future, you cannot make prophecies, you have to understand the past. That is because the future is not predicted, it is rehearsed. The limits of prediction. What has sustained our collective faith in prediction was not its accuracy, but the environment in which it operated. In the past, errors unfolded slowly, and institutions had time to respond and adjust. When forecasts failed, the consequences were often contained and reversible, which allowed prediction to persist as a useful illusion rather than a dependable guide. What has changed is not our ability to see the future clearly, but our ability to absorb being wrong. The margin for error that once existed across institutions, economies, and societies has narrowed significantly. Pressures that once arrived sequentially now arrive simultaneously, interacting and reinforcing one another in ways that are difficult to isolate or manage independently. We are living through a period in which technological acceleration coincides with demographic aging, geopolitical realignment, environmental constraints, and deep social strain. Economic systems are asked to deliver growth while absorbing volatility. Political systems are expected to respond at speeds they were never designed to handle. Questions of identity, trust, and responsibility move from abstract debate into daily life, and these pressures do not operate in isolation. They accumulate, compound, and converge. Most systems are built to adapt, and for long stretches of time, that is enough. Organizations adjust processes, markets reprice risk, institutions revise rules in response to changing conditions. Over time, however, accumulated pressure erodes flexibility. Decisions become harder to reverse. Options narrow, and incremental adjustment stops being sufficient. When that happens, systems do not collapse immediately, but they do begin to reconfigure at a structural level rather than continue adapting at the margins. This pattern's been particularly visible since the coronavirus pandemic. Supply chains optimized for efficiency fractured under stress and were rebuilt around resilience. Work structures designed for stability gave way to more fluid and fragmented arrangements. Legal and political institutions built for slower change strain when events consistently outpace their capacity to respond. These are not isolated failures or temporary disruptions. They are signals that adaptation is giving way to reconfiguration. In this environment, prediction becomes not just unreliable, but actively misleading. Being wrong is survivable when errors remain localized and unfold slowly. When the consequences of being wrong are immediate and severe, making predictions can lead decision makers astray. Because of the speed of our modern society, by the time clarity arrives, the opportunity to respond meaningfully has often passed. The weakness of prediction was always present. What has changed is our exposure to its failure. Rehearsing the future. So, rather than asking what will happen, I focus on a different question. How does pressure build over time? And what happens when multiple pressures collide? That framing shifts attention away from outcomes and toward structures. This line of thinking led me to develop what I call possibility chains. It begins with close observation of what is changing right now. New capabilities entering daily life, shifting behaviors, emerging limits, and institutional responses that lag or accelerate. From there, I assess how the variables involved with this change interact. For instance, a technological shift alters economic incentives, which reshapes how people learn, work, and define security. Social responses provoke political action, which in turn shapes how technologies are governed or constrained. Each step follows a causal logic that can be examined and tested as conditions evolve. The objective is not to identify a single inevitable future, but to understand how different developments might combine over time. When these interactions are traced across years rather than moments, patterns begin to emerge that can help us rehearse, not predict, the future. This is where possibility chains move beyond description and become practical. They're not exercises in optimism or alarm, but tools for creating a decision space. Each plausible future carries both upside and downside. A new capability can unlock productivity and creativity or deepen inequality and fragility, depending on how it is adopted. That should be adopted. That was a strange hyphenation. Depending on how it is adopted and governed. Institutional reform can restore trust and coordination or entrench new forms of exclusion. Environmental constraints can accelerate innovation or trigger instability, depending on timing and response. Making these trade-offs visible before pressure forces a choice is the central value of rehearsal. This kind of preparation is common in other high-stakes domains. Pilots do not attempt to predict every emergency they might face. They rehearse responses to plausible sequences of failure, so they're not improvising under pressure. Cities do not predict every disaster. They rehearse coordination, so response does not depend on perfect foresight. In complex systems, readiness comes from practice rather than certainty. Possibility chains apply that same logic to systems undergoing coordinated pressure across multiple domains. They allow institutions, organizations, and communities to walk through plausible futures. Rather than debating whether a single forecast is right or wrong, they help decision makers prepare for the conditions that make certain outcomes more likely, while there's still room to influence how those outcomes take shape. We are entering a period defined less by isolated disruption and more by interconnected constraints. This does not mean societal collapse is inevitable, but it does mean guessing our way forward is no longer sufficient. The cost of being wrong has risen, and the time available to respond has shortened. The future is not a destination waiting to be discovered. It is formed through pressure, interaction, and timing. We may never predict the future with precision, but we can rehearse how we respond. In a world like this one, rehearsal may be the most practical form of foresight we have. I'll take a few seconds now to describe the front cover of the Time magazine, which I usually do at the onset of the broadcast. It's, as usual, it's bordered in red and narrowly bordered in white, with Time in large block capital lettering in white superimposed upon a pale gray-blue background. There are people's faces, photographs of people's faces on the cover, but they're not identified. And three males and two females. They all look youngish. One is wearing glasses, one of the men. One of the women is blonde. The other is dark-haired. Two of the men have dark curly hair, and one has slicked back grayish hair. The men's hair is all cut short. There's a collage, kind of a patriotic collage, behind the faces on the pale gray-blue cover. A U.S. flag is flying, and the eagle with the U.S. flag shield on its chest is shown. And at the bottom of the photographic collage is an image of the Pentagon. Okay, now moving on to another article. This is also an essay. Many have called Jeffrey Epstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N, the American financier and convicted child sex offender, a monster. This article is written by Tarana, T-A-R-A-N-A, Burke, B-U-R-K-E. Burke is founder of the Me Too movement and co-chair of All In. As fitting as this title may be, it also obfuscates the insidiousness of sexual violence. The primary narrative of the Epstein files has so far been focused on how one powerful man cleverly enmeshed with other powerful men and some women in his massive network of privilege and exploitation through the promise of access to others who are rich, powerful, and influential. But this is not the lesson the Epstein scandal should teach Americans. Those of us fighting to end sexual and gender-based violence have cautioned against this framing of the abuse, which renders the exploitation of young girls and women simply a shocking deviation from the standards of acceptable behavior, rather than the product of entrenched power structures. If we label Epstein a monster, we whitewash the environment that created, fostered, and abetted him. The real lesson of the Epstein files is this: we built the world that made him possible. Epstein was not the disease, he was a symptom. While symptoms may disappear with treatment, diseases need to be cured. What's more, Epstein was not an anomaly. His case simply highlighted what happens when power goes unaccountable, when silence is rewarded, and when child sexual abuse is treated as a private scandal rather than a public emergency. If the conditions that produce, protect, and empower men like Epstein are entirely of our own making, that also means they are entirely within our power to change. Sexual and gender-based violence is solvable, and the Epstein files should be our call to finally act like it. For those of us who work to end the global pandemic of sexual and gender-based violence, it is all too clear that male violence against women is painfully common. The sexual abuse of girls and women has been normalized and is routinely blamed on the actions of a few bad apples. It is so normalized we cannot believe it, even when it is happening in plain sight. This is not to say the public anger toward Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell is not justified. The details are disturbing, and the scale of harm is staggering. We need this anger, but we need to harness it better to help us answer troubling questions about the societies we live in. Questions like, what kind of world makes Epstein's web of power and those who participated, knew, and stayed silent, possible? And crucially, what kind of world would have stopped it? The biggest question, what can we learn from the information and patterns emerging from these files that can help us identify the current Epsteins still operating in obscurity? It is tempting to treat Epstein as an outlier, but that story is too simple. Epstein operated in a system that protects status and male entitlement. He did not abuse power in a vacuum. He abused power in a culture that too often excuses it. Sexual and gender-based violence is not rare. Worldwide, nearly 1 in 3 women will experience physical or sexual violence in her lifetime. 1 in 8 girls globally experiences sexual abuse before she turns 18. Boys are not safe either. Sexual violence is disproportionately perpetrated by men and driven by gender inequality and unequal power relations. These are not marginal figures. They are structural and everyday realities. The problem is systemic. When abuse happens at the highest levels of business and politics, the damage runs deep. Survivors are re-traumatized. Institutions lose credibility and public trust erodes. The Epstein scandal illuminated the lengths to which power protects itself. It is important in our response to the Epstein files that we do not buttress these power structures. We must listen to survivors. We must learn about the hell they went through. And we must untangle the range of debilitating consequences women and girls experience because of gendered, unequal power structures, not just those created by wealthy and influential individuals. Coverage of the sexual violence and abuse inflicted on Epstein's and his conspirators' survivors must go further than fascination and disbelief. We must remember that these powerful people operate within already existing power structures, which enable violence against women and girls. We must remember that this violence is not inevitable. It does not have to be an acceptable way of life. It is preventable, because sexual and gender-based violence is solvable. We have frameworks. We have tested programs. Decades of research suggest well-designed, evidence-based interventions can reduce violence, sometimes by up to 50%. We must fund solutions that decrease the current violence while actively dismantling the roots of this structural problem. The kind of world that could have stopped Epstein's web of abuse already exists, in theory. We just need to put it into practice. We know, for example, schools have the potential to be a powerful tool to prevent sexual violence. Schools do not just transmit knowledge, they shape norms. Norms shape whether abuse is tolerated or challenged. We know that this needs to change and how to change it. Evidence-based solutions exist. They just need to be taken to scale. For instance, when education systems embed consent, gender equality, and respectful relationships into curriculums, and then pair that with policies that respond swiftly and seriously to harassment, violence declines. Messages about preventing sexual violence and building healthy relationships can shift peer norms and reduce the acceptance of violence. School programs can change attitudes, interrupt harmful behaviors before they become entrenched, and improve relationship outcomes. Engaging boys in conversations about healthy masculinity is also critical, because research indicates when we equate manhood with dominance, conquest, and entitlement, sexual violence will spread. If we're serious about preventing future Epsteins, boys and men must be central to the solution, not as saviors, but first as survivors themselves and as accountable participants. That means calling out abuse within professional networks, refusing to shield powerful friends, demanding transparent investigations, and supporting survivor-centered systems. What holds us all back from addressing gender-based sexual violence is a lack of breadth, coordination, and sustained political will. We're stuck in disbelief and in stories about monsters, but there are no boogeymen. They're simply powerful men who do monstrous things. In practice, this world that could have been prevented, that could have prevented sexual exploitation perpetrated by Epstein, does not treat sexual exploitation and violence as a personal scandal, but as a governance and cultural failure. It is a world where institutions build safeguards long before abuse surfaces. It's a world where prevention is embedded everywhere. Schools teach consent, respect, and equality as foundational skills. Workplaces treat harassment and exploitation as core risks to culture and performance, not reputational inconveniences. Online platforms enforce zero-harm commitments. Media and entertainment mitigate harm by monitoring excessive and gratuitous gender-based violence in messaging. Governments integrate prevention across health, education, justice, labor, and technology sectors, a world where silence and inaction are no longer neutral. Public anger can be a catalyst, but anger alone will not prevent the next predator. Accountability and transparency matter. So do commitments to protect the safety and dignity of every citizen, even children. However, without a sustained focus on preventing harm before it happens and upending the systems that facilitate the harm, we will repeat the cycle. Solutions require investment, It requires leadership across all sectors. It requires refusing complacency. And it requires us to stop blaming our societal issues on monsters. Here's something from the reviews section. Television, A Soul Deep Friendship, Lost in a Shallow Murder Mystery by Judy Berman. A competition to determine TV's most generic domestic thriller would have dozens of compelling entrants, but if I had to pick a winner, it would be Imperfect Women. Like so many of its predecessors, the Apple TV series begins with a murder. The victim is a rich, beautiful woman. The cast is led by famous female actors Kerry Washington, Elizabeth Moss, Kate Mara. Themes include class anxiety, infidelity, trauma, jealousy, and male fragility. Every character has secrets, and the show is based on a novel of the same name by executive producer Araminta Hall. It has everything you would expect from this overly abundant genre, in other words, but nothing that truly sets it apart. Creator Annie Weissman, Physical, makes a point of centering the 25-year bond between three women. It feels cheap to call it friendship. Washington intones in the premiere over shots where she's dancing blissfully with Moss and Mara. It was something else, like a kinship from deep in our souls. Unfortunately, the show never quite captures the transcendence it keeps talking up, nor does it have anything new to say on the perennial topic of female friendship. The stars of Imperfect Women all seem trapped in separate stories. This is, to some extent, the result of a three-part season in which each takes her turn as narrator. Yet it is also a function of simultaneously disparate and familiar tones. Each actor's role draws heavily on the most memorable characters she has played in the past. In an echo of House of Cards, Mara's Nancy is a femme fatale, impetuous, sexy, haunted. Though she's been married to Robert, Joel Kinnaman, a scion of the ultra-wealthy Hennessy clan, for long enough to raise a teenager, Nancy grew up amid poverty and abuse in a stereotypical trailer park and remains an outsider in her husband's family. 15 minutes into the premiere, she's dead. When we hear her side of the story, it's from beyond the grave. Earlier on the night of her murder, she's out for a celebratory dinner with her two besties. A daughter of privilege, Eleanor Washington, runs a humanitarian nonprofit and is having a half-hearted dalliance with an employee, Rome Flynn. If that sketch isn't enough to put you in mind of Washington's scandal lead, the D.C. fixer Olivia Pope, dialogue laced with emphatic repetition and words like optics will. Moss channels Mad Men's Peggy Olson and June from The Handmaid's Tale as Mary, a housewife and mother of three, whose timid exterior belies a steely, frustrated intelligence. Each performance is solid in isolation, but the show never brings them together with enough electricity to make us feel the love these women have for one another. We barely see all three in the same room before the murder. While we gather, Mary and Eleanor are mesmerized by Nancy. It's hard to tell what makes her so special. Along with its shallow invocation of the power of female friendship, Imperfect Women nods toward pat takeaways about gender, race, class, heterosexual love, and intergenerational friction without offering novel insight. fortified with episodic cliffhangers and a glamorous LA setting. It might make a satisfactory binge for devotees of the genre. Just don't expect authentic kinship, let alone depth or soul. New episodes of Imperfect Women debut Wednesdays on Apple TV. Here's the last page, Seven Questions by Alice Park. This is the question-answer format. Damar or Damar, D-A-M-A-R, Hamlin, H-A-M-L-I-N. The NFL player on life since cardiac arrest at midfield, promoting athletes' heart health, and what shrinks fear. Question, how do you respond to parents who think football is too dangerous for their kids? Answer, I wouldn't blame them, but I will also say fear is a choice. There are a lot of great things you learn through sports. I would not allow the fear of something negative happening stop me from achieving all the character building and life lessons that come with sports. Question, before your sudden cardiac arrest after a tackle in 2023, how important was heart health education to you? Answer, ironically, my very first course ever as a college athlete was a CPR course. I vividly remember being fresh out of high school, and it was the first class for me and my classmates at the University of Pittsburgh. We were super locked in. We took it very seriously because we understood the importance of saving someone's life. But everyone doesn't always have that perspective to take it seriously until it affects someone close to them. So that's why I've been on the mission of using my experience to lead the charge in getting everyone CPR training. Question, after your experience, why did you decide to advocate for educating people about heart health? Answer, earlier on in the hospital, I was at a crossroads where I really wanted to just focus on my personal health and on enjoying the experience of still being able to live, to be able to breathe, to be a son and a big brother. But I knew I had an opportunity to use my platform to inspire others and give people who have had a heart health experience a platform. It was a mental battle. There was a long period of time when I was traveling and training people to learn CPR, and it is traumatic just to see a CPR instruction dummy on the ground. It's triggering. It reminds me of the worst things of that moment. But I knew I was helping to save lives and allowing people with the same experience I had to see more tomorrows. Question, what helped you face those fears? Answer, I really learned a lot about fear throughout this experience. One way I noticed how you can root out all fear is through love. Love truly pushes out all fear. So I just wanted to lead with love, and that made the fear shrink more and more and more. Question, was there a time when you thought you might not play football again? Answer, early on, it was assumed I would not be able to go back and play. But I knew that if given the opportunity, I still had more to offer the game of football. And I'm so glad I got to prove it. Question, have the NFL and other sports organizations prioritized heart health education enough? Answer, the message that I preach through my Chasing M's Foundation is that we are tackling the leading cause of death in youth sports, sudden cardiac arrest. I do not want kids to shy away from playing sports like football. It is about doing it safely and making sure the necessary things are in place if something were to happen, so that we can have the best results possible, like in my situation. We're now nearing $1 million given away in automated electronic defibrillators, AEDs, the device that restarted my heart. The NFL started the Smart Hearts Coalition due to my situation. We've been trying to get AEDs into all 50 states, into all schools, and they stay proactive in trying to find ways they can show up for the things we as players care about. Question, the last one. Having come so close to death, what do you now see through different eyes? Answer, I truly just appreciate life. I am able to shift from a bad moment quickly because I have all the reasons in the world to not be in a bad mood. I'm still here with the blessing of life. It can be enough sometimes just to be able to smile and breathe and know that whatever I'm going through, I have another chance to make it right, do it better, start over, and refresh. The next article, which is very long, will be abridged. Under the caption, Space, Rocket Woman, at Elon Musk's right hand at SpaceX, Gwynne Shotwell is aiming to get AI into orbit and humans back to the moon, by Jeffrey Kluger. There are 18 Starship spacecraft in various stages of construction arrayed across the 1 million square foot floor of the SpaceX factory in Starbase, Texas. Some of them are for now just stainless steel barrels measuring nearly 30 feet across. Others have already been assembled and outfitted with their tapered nose cones and are ready to be stacked atop a first stage booster, taking final shape as SpaceX's 40-story Starship rockets. 11 uncrewed Starships have been launched since 2023, some successfully, some not, each of them producing a staggering 16.7 million pounds of thrust from its 33 first-stage engines, more than double the ground-shaking power of the Apollo-era Saturn V. On a recent Friday in February, none of that violence was in evidence as work proceeded in the gleaming white factory. Some of the welding is done robotically, but mostly these are hand-built rockets, artisanal rockets. Despite that old-world craftsmanship, they're getting built fast, with a goal of getting launched fast, aiming to meet NASA's goal of pressing fresh American boot prints on the moon during the flight of the mission dubbed Artemis IV in 2 years' time. Starship is the newest rocket in the SpaceX lineup, a step up in power from its popular Falcon 9 model. Artemis is NASA's new lunar program, which will be buying services from SpaceX's Starship. It's a hard problem, and the whole architecture is complex, but we're gunning for 2028, says SpaceX President and Chief Operating Officer Gwynne Shotwell, 62, as she stands on a walkway overlooking the factory floor. It is possible that one of the vehicles under construction here could be the 21st century equivalent of Apollo 11's lunar module, Eagle, the lander that carried the first humans to the surface of the moon in 1969. But Shotwell's hoping that test flights will proceed so quickly that all of these spacecraft will have flown by the time of Artemis IV. By 2028, she says, gesturing to the 18 starships, these should be long gone. They better have flown by then. When Shotwell says something had better happen, it better. A veteran of nearly 40 years in the aerospace sector, she's one of its top players. Shotwell's second on the SpaceX org chart, behind only CEO and founder Elon Musk, leading an $800 billion company that is about to get a lot bigger. February 2, SpaceX announced it's merging with XAI, Musk's artificial intelligence company. The combined operation will be worth a reported $1.5 trillion, a valuation that will be tested when the privately held company, Time co-owner Mark Benioff is an investor, begins selling stock. The initial public offering is set for the second quarter of 2026. I am not supposed to talk about the IPO in any way, says Shotwell, but I am looking forward to it. It's a new thing, a new set of methodologies to run companies, so I'm excited about it. It also means Shotwell will occupy an even bigger position in an even larger operation, one that has plans not just to dominate the aerospace sector, but also to settle other worlds and reroute the course of human history. Starship could be the machine that helps make that happen. The goal of having these 18 rockets out the door in 2 years is actually a slow pace of launch for SpaceX. Since the first successful flight of the company's workhorse Falcon 9 rocket in 2010, the vehicle's flown more than 600 times, including 165 launches in 2025 alone. Assuming Starship proves its flight worthiness, it will have a lot of work to do in addition to taking astronauts to the moon. Its enormous dimensions allow it to carry 50 or more satellites to orbit, a big plus as SpaceX seeks to expand its Starlink internet constellation from its current 9,400 satellites to 20,000. On February 13, Starlink passed the 10 million customer mark, with its reach expanding beyond the commercial sector and into conflict zones around the world, including Ukraine, Gaza, and Iran. As artificial intelligence expands, the company sees a place for a similar constellation of satellites serving as data centers in space. SpaceX envisions linking the satellites by laser, giving them the power to process information as a single, distributed brain. We just recently gave a request for FCC licensing for up to 1 million AI satellites, says Shotwell. I'm surprised that didn't get more news. I don't know if we'll get to 1 million, but it's much easier to ask at the beginning and then march toward that goal. SpaceX's FCC application made a number of arguments for its proposed mega constellation. Energy efficiency and carbon reduction were a big part of the pitch, as terrestrial data centers gulp enormous amounts of power and millions of gallons of coolant water. Placing AI satellites in orbits that keep them constantly charged by solar panels and constantly cooled by the infinite heat sink of space mitigates this problem. Getting 1 million satellites into orbit would be a heavy lift, literally, but in an interview on the Cheeky Pint podcast posted to X, Musk suggested launching Starship with the regularity of airplanes taking off from airports, reaching 10,000 launches per year. Starship could not only accommodate 50 or more satellites, it could also seat hundreds of passengers, a critical capability in Musk's long-term vision of making humanity a multi-world species. Since the founding of SpaceX in 2002, Musk has made colonizing Mars a long-term goal. When I came to the company as a new employee, says William Gersenmeyer, SpaceX's vice president of build and flight reliability, the first discussion was about how we go to Mars. It was not about how you fill out your time card. But in a February 8 post on X, Musk announced a change. SpaceX has already shifted focus to building a self-growing city on the moon, as we can potentially achieve that in less than 10 years, he wrote, whereas Mars would take 20-plus years. Shotwell will get a lot less than 20 years, or even 10, to stick the planned Artemis 4 moon landing. In 2021, NASA selected the company to build Artemis's so-called Human Landing System, HLS, the vehicle that will set down on the moon with two astronauts aboard, while two others station keep in the Orion mothership orbiting above. NASA cut the company a $2.9 billion check to get the job done. Blue Origin, the rocket company owned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and one of the losers in the initial HLS bidding, was given a fat consolation prize in 2023 when NASA issued it a second $3.4 billion contract to build its own HLS for a later moon landing, Artemis 5. Artemis 1, an uncrewed flight around the moon to test NASA's Orion capsule, flew in 2022. After that, the plan had been to fly Artemis 2 on a crewed trip around the moon, a mission that is scheduled to launch now and then land on the moon with Artemis 3 in 2028. From the tiny Texas city of Starbase, population 500, Shotwell will help expand humanity's footprint out into the solar system. That article was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsugsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.